It's a weekend of a memorial of events that took place now more than two centuries ago. As we often think of July 4th, 1776, it sort of rings in people's ears if they have studied anything or heard anything that is traditional of American history. What I wanted to do this evening is to say that there is a whole section of the Bible that you should read in connection with this event that we commemorate once every year. To put it in simple terms, the United States is indeed a remarkable nation. Now in a special way, but even if we did not know our national identity, in a special way, this nation is going to have to face what it means to be a superpower and to potentially lose that superpower status. Smaller nations can afford to lose status. Great nations cannot truly afford to lose status without collapsing. I think we have to realize that far more than most have ever thought about. Great nations are attacked and assaulted by others. They have things that others want. This is what happened to Babylon. This is what happened to Persia. It happened to the Greeks and the Greek realms, to Rome. Rome was, in fact, bludgeoned to death, assaulted decade after decade after decade until it collapsed in the West. Smaller people can come and go. People don't take notice. Sometimes smaller people also, in their region, may be what we would call regional powers, as the Armenians were, and have paid a very terrible price in their history. Because other nations came in and ultimately occupied much of their land. The Bible is made up of two kinds of prophets. I'm speaking here of books. Books that we call the former prophets and books that we call the latter prophets. Most of us, if we look at a King James Version of the Bible, would, in a sense, start reading the prophets with the book of Isaiah. And we would end with the book of Malachi, or wonder what to do with Daniel. But in reality, the prophets do not start with Isaiah. Isaiah only begins the latter prophets. There were the former prophets who wrote very important books of the Bible. Now, unlike the latter prophets who simply told a few things about history in order to use them as illustrations, the latter prophets as a whole spoke of events yet to come, and we are told that they will certainly come even if we have to wait and wait and wait till they do. They're essentially messages for the latter day, very loosely attached to any events of their time by way of example. Hence, there's a little reference to the fall of Israel in Isaiah, somewhat of a reference to the fall of Jerusalem in Ezekiel. But the message of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the others look into the future, taking aspects of the past only as some kind of guide for specific and lengthy messages. But now the former prophets are different. The former prophets wrote what we call a historic perspective. And they are telling it in a historic framework. And they are giving very few messages in terms comparable to Isaiah, for instance. But we're asked to read their message not as history alone, but as the implication of what history can mean for later generations. Now, the former prophets begin with Joshua. And we need, at this point, to go back to the Hebrew Bible and to forget what the Greek librarians in Alexandria thought when they developed a way of organizing the books of the Bible that have come down to us out of the Greek and Roman world, so that we don't see the real picture and the real story. Because when you look at what you have in the Authorized or King James Version or comparable versions, that is, every basic version of the Old Testament in English, other than a Jewish translation or Farrar Fenton, you simply don't have this picture at all. Oh yes, you might have Joshua, Judges, and then Ruth would be put in, which is not a part. You would have the two books of Samuel, the two books of Kings, which are part of the former prophets, and you would find after would be the books of Chronicles, and Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. But actually, Chronicles and Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther have nothing to do with this story. It is unfortunate that this aspect is lost. But it is our responsibility, at least, to make it known to you. And I want to take a look at it. We're dealing here with a group of books as finally divided in the printed editions. They compose six books of the former prophets: Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings, as we normally name them. It's the story of the settlement of Palestine. It's the story of the period of Judges. It's the story of the monarchy at its high point. It's the story of the divided nation or church, Israel and Judah. It's the story of the ultimate exile of both Israel and Judah. It's the story of the entry of a people into a land that was promised them and their exit. In the one case, in 7 centuries, these are rough terms, in the other case, in approximately 8.5 centuries. It is hard to realize that the whole story, from the fall of Israel back to the entry into the promised land, was not more than 7 centuries. And since 59 have elapsed from the story of Adam, we realize that this is really one very small part, not more than 1/8 of the history of human experience. We may think it rather a long period, but it was not as long as one might imagine. Those 7 centuries would take us back to a period significantly after William the Conqueror came to Britain. And he came to Britain in the 11th century. We would have to go from that back to the departure of the Romans around 410 A.D. to have another period of 700 years. In other words, we are dealing with a period that is half of the time between the departure of Rome and the present day, if we were to look to Great Britain as an illustration. Now, the meaning of these books can easily be lost if all we think of is that we are studying what Joshua did, how the land was divided, what Judges did that has no bearing today, or what Kings did who lived and died and whose experience is not being repeated today. That is, if we think it isn't. The fact remains, we're not asked to read it as just history or just geography. We're asked to read it to understand what is the moral issue that is addressed. Because kings are praised, not because they did great deeds, or rejected because they did not do great deeds. They are addressed, as also the judges, on the fundamental premise of whether a person did good or evil in the sight of God. Today, there was a debate. I was listening to it as we were ready to leave the house on the McNeil-Lehrer report, which we get on radio. It's the only radio station that carries it. It belongs to the University of Southern California. Otherwise, it's normally seen on television. But this particular program is significant because this evening it was addressing the question of whether we are indeed losing our national competitiveness. And the whole argument from either point of view was simply economic. As if the economic problems today are fundamental. There was not a single issue raised as to whether the problem was economic or moral, that is, spiritual. You remember what Mr. Armstrong wrote long ago in the story of Roger Babson at the beginning of the 1920s, that you don't want to look at the state of affairs today in terms of the heat in the room. You want to look at what is happening to the boiler in the basement in terms of what is going to occur. Now, that boiler was, in Roger Babson's view, a perspective on human morality. Now, his view was something like this: when essentially the nation is more than 50% doing what is right, we can look for things looking up, or prosperity. When it is, on other occasions, doing things that are not right, more than 50%, it's likely to go the other way. Now, Roger Babson, of course, didn't take Abraham's view. He wondered if you could survive in Sodom even with 10 people left. So, God does not necessarily do it on a 50-50 basis. The story of Abraham, bargaining with God for Lot and his family to spare the whole city just for their sakes, God said he would do it even for a small fraction. But the point is, Abraham saw that the issue was a moral issue. And would he overlook the majority sins even for the sake of a few who were doing what is right? And God said yes. You set the number 10, and I'll agree with that. As it turned out, the number was only 4, and even that was high. So God didn't have to keep his part of the bargain, and the city was destroyed, and Abraham had to learn that the rest of the family of Lot perished, other than those 4 of whom we have the record. And, of course, one of them did en route out. We should take a look at these particular books of the Bible from a certain point of view. And I would like to state this point of view now. We have knowledge about the identity of this nation. But this is July 4. This is not July 4 celebrated in Australia, Canada, Britain, Scandinavia, or Northwestern Europe, or the Alpine region. It's simply an American experience based on what happened more than 2 centuries ago. It could apply in principle, and if I were in another country on Canada Day or in Australia, they'll be celebrating their 200th anniversary next year, then we would address the question in a similar fashion to those countries. Now, what is important to realize is that we do know our identity. Therefore, we can have a clearer view of what the story is here, because the identity of this nation is essentially that of a dominant people of whom this story in the Bible is written. That is the birthright people, one of the 2 tribes holding the birthright in the family of Israel. Now, in a certain sense, what is here could apply equally to China. But in another sense, it cannot. So I want to explain something first off. This land was not given after the flood to the people who now dwell here. This land was given to another people. Essentially, the land of China was given to the people who dwell there. The Chinese will never be taken captive and totally removed from China. For the simple reason that is their land. Their problems will essentially be of their own making, and they will suffer what their neighbors impose on them and what they do to themselves in their own land. That is theirs. But you see, both the land that we call Canaan and what we call Anglo-North America was not originally our land. And that now presents a different problem. It's a very important one. Because it actually belonged to someone else before. It wasn't the so-called land of Canaan. It was Canaan's land. And Canaan forfeited it. And now we'll touch that in a moment. But we want to recognize that when a people comes into a land that really belonged to someone else, and when God deals with that nation, it is just possible when God deals thoroughly with that nation that those people may not stay in that land unless they break off their sin. And hence the church has warned that we face not merely a tragedy in this country, as the Germans faced a tragedy in Germany as a result of Nazism that they had espoused. They're still there. We call it East and West Germany. They were driven out of occupied lands. The East is no longer dominant in Prussia or German Poland or in parts of Eastern Europe and the Balkans. But they live where they are. We have warned this nation for more than 50 years that what is going to happen is that we will be removed from a land just as the ancient Israelites were. And the reason we will be removed is that if the people who were here before deserve to be removed and we do the same things they did, we will deserve to be removed. Now we come to the background of our story, which is not in Joshua, but is in the book of Genesis. So let me turn to the background of the book of Genesis here momentarily. Because if you don't understand this, you will have difficulty understanding the difference between why we have a different consequence to sin than, let us say, the Chinese or the people of India would. In the book of Genesis, chapter 14, we have the story of what was occurring when there was a struggle between Mesopotamia with four kings and Canaanites with five kings as Abraham was entering this land. Abraham gained a victory, and we are told on his return, so you fill in the background, which is not essential here, that as Abraham returned, Melchizedek, the king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God." And Abraham gave tithes. Now what is significant here is often overlooked. This is not a study on Melchizedek or a study of this part of Genesis. It is simply to say that the church's teaching may be verified, if you wish, in other literature that is available. The church points out that what is described in the book of Hebrews and what is described here pertaining to Melchizedek refers to a person whose name is King of Righteousness. And the place he was responsible for, as ruler, is the city of peace. And he has no recorded lineage. And he is a priest. And to him tithes are paid. And commentators tell us, foolishly, that this was just a Canaanite king. A Canaanite king who is a king of righteousness, whose city deserves to be named Peace, a king who is a priest of the Most High God, to whom Abraham would give tithes. So this gives you, in general, a perception of the wisdom of those who write commentaries. Paul says, consider how great this personage was, to whom Abraham gave a tenth of all, about whom we have no record of his birth or death, as you would have expected of a king. This is the story, if you please, of the one whom we have already seen earlier in Genesis, whom we call the Lord in English, the spokesman. This is the one who we would call Yahweh, the one who is, the one who exists, the one who speaks, and who functions as a speaker, as a priest, for the great creator God. God created all things by Jesus Christ. Yet there are those, for instance, who have even gone before us in the church in earlier generations, and there are ministers in the Church of God Seventh Day who would say that there was no living Jesus Christ before he was conceived in Mary's womb. Now, if he was not living and only came to be, that is, if you take the view of Dr. Arius, the non-Trinitarian view, then God did not create all things by Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ was not then there. Who then were these who came down and said to one another when they beheld Babel, behold now what man is doing? Who were these who said, let us make man after our image? If there was only God and Jesus Christ never existed before the birth, the conception in Mary's womb. All right, so much for the background. Now, here is a case, and it's very important to understand this if you're going to understand what happened to Israel as distinct from what happened to Arameans, to Egyptians, and others as a whole. The Egyptians have paid their penalty as a whole in the lands in which they have lived, though some were prophesied to be expelled. But many people have suffered in the lands they have lived in. The Persians are still there. The Greeks are still there. Anybody who's in Rome is happy to tell you he's a Roman, he's still there. But the United States, when the final catastrophe comes, won't be here anymore. Its people will be replaced by another. Not equal in numbers, for sure, because this country will also be drought-ridden and have many other natural problems. But go back now to Melchizedek. In the land of Canaan, there is a little city called Peace. A town, a city would be an improper word in the sense that we think of as the city of Pasadena. It would simply be something equivalent, if you know the size of the small sites archaeologically under excavation in the Middle East, we would say it's something like what we would think of in terms of the greater area of our campus here. There were towns that were often in times past not more than a few hectares or acres. Just a few. A few buildings. You wonder what Melchizedek did with the tithes. He didn't put them in a balloon and send them off to heaven. I mention that because of what's happened today. If you remember this transatlantic crossing that didn't quite get over there. Sadly. No, the tithe would have been used. God does not put it up in a napkin. It wasn't put away for some future day. It was being used. And it was being used to build a place called peace. That is, you could come here as distinct from Sodom and Gomorrah and you would find peace. Now, if you wanted to visit Sodom and Gomorrah, there was a different perspective. You want to know what it was like when the angels came there as Lot? Yes. You can read it in the book of Genesis. One of the great tragedies. It was far and beyond anything that San Francisco can provide today. Much worse. But there was a place called peace. Now, it was not like Hazor, which was the military capital of Canaanites in the north. This was a place called peace. I want you to get the point, get the feel. Of all the little places, of all the big places, Canaan was a land of many kings and many city-states. It was not one Egypt under a pharaoh. It was not Mesopotamia under a great city-state that lorded it over others. As in the case of the first dynasty of Babylon. That dynasty we associate with the name of Hammurabi, but that's not the only person in the dynasty. It just happens to be a name that has come down because of this stela that was found where the law of Hammurabi was engraved. Mesopotamia was generally dominated by major city-states. Canaan was not so dominated. There were various groups that worked together, but most of them worked on their own. And each king had a particular area. Now it so happened that and we don't know the background, if Abraham bought a place to bury his family, there is no reason that Yahweh would not have bought a place in the land of Canaan as priest of God to build. The Canaanites were good businessmen and they would see a good deal here and they had no reason not to sell. There were honest people among them who wanted to give. David refused to receive from the Canaanite king the site of the Temple Mount. It wasn't a king then, I should say, but a chieftain, let us say. He paid for it. Abraham refused a direct gift. He paid for what he purchased around Hebron for the burial of his family. So we can perceive that the priest, Yahweh, now known as Melchizedek in this story, first of all, he bought a piece of land in a beautiful hilly area that we now know as Jerusalem. And he starts to build with the tithe of those who know that he is priest of God Most High. And he creates a small place where you could come to visit, to counsel, to learn the truth. This was not like the real world of Canaan. This was the ambassador campus of that day, and he was the ambassador. I've told you many times the story of my friend Jacob Seitlin, friend of the college, the book dealer who, upon leaving this campus, said, "Now to go back real world." I think it's a very important phrase that you should not forget. Because ambassador is not the world around us. It is an oasis. The same thing may be said in East Texas of our sister campus there. Now I want you to consider the fact that Melchizedek didn't do this in Beijing. He didn't do this in Delhi. He didn't do this in Anuradhapura. You want to know where that is? That's in Sri Lanka, the ancient capital. He didn't do this in Athens. He didn't do this in Ecbatana or in Babylon or Eblon or Damascus, where the Arameans were. I want you to think of the implication. What he built was in a land so that a people were without excuse in a way that other nations might have been considered as having excuses because they saw no such example. God did not give such an example to ancient China. In return, he never told the Chinese that they would have to be expelled from their land. Now you get the picture? He didn't place such a site in that land because he was not giving the land of China to someone else. But he did place this site in the land of Canaan, and we don't know how much earlier than the call of Abraham this occurred. We don't know. He was already known as a king. He's not introduced as coming there in Abraham's day. The Canaanites, in all likelihood, had seen this small site on the hills of Jerusalem, what we would call the earlier part of the Middle Bronze Age, as archaeologists define it. They would have seen this site and should have known how to live in their cities. And while this oasis of peace was occurring, Sodom was going its way, Gomorrah was going its way, and the other cities of the plain. Hazor was developing its military strength. The city-states were quarreling with one another, whereas the Egyptian fellaheen may have had to live in peace through circumstances essentially beyond their own, because Pharaoh had all the power. The cities of Canaan were not like that. They were in the land, and around the city wall were glacis, or very heavily compacted cement-like areas that protected the foot of the wall, so that you couldn't use a battering ram to get to the wall. You would just be going up like this. The most remarkably defended cities anywhere in the history of antiquity were the cities of Canaan, because the cities of Canaan were not the cities of peace. If you please, the Canaanites thought like the people of Lebanon are thinking today around the capital of Beirut. You see, the people right now who are living in that area are the descendants of one of the stocks of Canaan, the Sidonians, who were not expelled by the children of Israel. And every once in a while, the Greeks perceive that before a nation is punished, God, the gods, as the Greeks thought of it, made them mad. The Greeks were mad, and they fell to the Macedonians, and then spread around the known world. There was once reasonable quiet for a while after 1948 in Lebanon, but the country is mad today. There's no way to explain it. They are not thinking in terms of peace. If you want to know what the land of Canaan was as a whole, from the time of Abraham and especially to the time of Joshua, you don't have to go any further than look at what is going on in Lebanon and the area of Beirut. And that will give you an understanding. Because that fits the state of mind that was characteristic of the city-states of Canaan. Now, there was one thing about the city of peace. It did not have a king who went to war. You could come there and be at peace, because the lands of Canaan, there were different tribes, the peoples of Canaan paid no serious attention to what God had been doing. He told them that they were going to be expelled from that land, and it would be given to another, and he even told them who it would be, and he brought that man in. And of course, they didn't believe his way, and they didn't believe that he would even do this, because Abraham didn't seem like that kind of person. And they even had friendship with Abraham when they knew that God had promised their land to him. They didn't see it made any difference. I mean, I know the Church of God keeps the Sabbath today, but I don't see as it makes any difference. I like them. They're Sabbath keepers. Oh, they even keep the Feast of Tabernacles and these other odd Jewish days. Well, we like them. They're nice neighbors. But I don't see why I have to do what they do. You know, we have friends of the world who don't believe God and still like it. Because God's character should make you likable. Now, they don't like you because of your religion. They like you in spite of your religion. Now, they like Melchizedek in spite of his religious ideas. You get the picture, you see. And for a long time, a lot of people liked Jesus in spite of his ideas. But then it got out of hand. His ideas began to catch on with too many, at least in the minds of those who were the religious leaders at the time. But Jesus knew it wasn't sinking in, but they thought it was. God set a direct example of what society should be. And he did it only in the land of Canaan. There is no other record in or out of the Bible of a God ever doing this anywhere else. And the people who were in the land were given a period of time. In fact, the Amorites, a not insignificant people, were confederated with Abraham, at least some of them were, and God said their iniquity isn't full and would be another 400 years after Abraham would die before their land would be inherited. Now, other Canaanite tribes probably had deserved it already, like Sodom and Gomorrah. The tribes were the people who dwelt in some of these towns, but God didn't punish them all until even the least evil had reached that point that they no longer deserved to be in the land, and then the conquest took place. Now let us read a story. Not a story, it's simply a warning in the book of Leviticus. A book, I told you we were looking in the former prophets, but we're really examining the background of the former prophets, because if you don't understand these verses, you simply won't understand the rest of the Bible. Chapter 18, the Lord says to Moses, "Speak to the children of Israel. Say to them, I'm the Lord your God. After the doings of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwell, shall you not do. After the doings of the land of Canaan, whither I bring you, shall you not do. Neither shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall do my judgment. Keep my ordinances," or in this case, statutes, "walk therein. I'm the Lord your God." Then it lists certain things. Verse 27. "For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled. So much so that the land," let me put it this way, "so much so that they were going to be expelled." Now, the story is, you shall, in verse 26, keep my statutes, and if not, that land will spew you out, is the warning. Look at it very carefully. "Defile not yourselves," verse 24. "The nations defile themselves, and I cast them out before you. Therefore, I visit the iniquity upon it, and the land itself vomits out its inhabitants." So you're to be aware that you don't do the same thing, so that the land spew not you out when you defile it, verse 28, "as it spewed out the nations that were before you. For whoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the soul that commits such shall be cut off," that is, excommunicated from among his people. And in some cases, the death penalty was to be enforced. Now think about this. The people who were in this land suffered as their penalty expulsion from the land. That was what was going to happen to them. Now they didn't all become expelled circumstantially. presumably the same would hold true with the house of Israel as far as every last person. But it is important that this kind of thing doesn't happen to every nation. I don't know of any nation that wants to live on the Japanese island other than Japan. I don't know of any people who want to live in India other than the Indians, or in China other than the Chinese. God will punish any nation that sins when he has not given their land to anybody else in the land. They're going to be punished in their land to reap the consequences of it. But the land of Canaan was different because God set an example and they did not follow it. And so God said, the nations around the example that I have set through Melchizedek, my priest, I'm speaking in the sense of how the Father is wording it, will be expelled. Now the statement is further amplified. Don't do these abominations so that the land doesn't spew you out. What happened to the ancient house of Israel? Oh, they did these very things. And guess what? They were spewed out. They went out of the land and do not live there now as far as the 10 tribes. God dealt with Judah somewhat differently. That's a separate matter for the moment. But even the Jews were ultimately expelled, but under different circumstances. God divorced Israel and sent them away, never to permit them to come back. Judah was simply separated and was allowed to come back. And then there occurred much, much later in the New Testament what we would call a family squabble. And the wife killed her husband. Now the Romans did the deed, but in a sense they hired him, like you have some murders today, for hire. Promised money to shut the mouths of those who might know the rest of the story. But that's a separate matter. We won't take time for this evening. Now, I have, in a sense, got ahead of the story. What we want to take note of briefly is that we are beginning here with a picture that unless you understand the meaning of Genesis 14, the meaning of Leviticus 18, the two most important single chapters, and not the whole chapter, but specific verses in these areas, you won't get the rest of the picture. You see, Joshua enters the promised land with the children of Israel. And then I'm going to skip the rest of the story for the moment, and then we come to near the close. And near the close, the nation is warned that they will go into an Assyrian captivity if they don't repent. And God sent one prophet after the other to the northern kingdom. They did not repent, and he sent them into ultimate exile. There's a verse in Isaiah that I want to read here, which is self-referred to, and for most people never associated with the fall of the house of Israel. There was a struggle taking place between Judah, on the one hand, and the house of Israel and Syria, or the Arameans, on the other. And so approximately the year 733, the Israelites and the Syrians had gotten together from Judah. Let us go up against Judah, Isaiah 7:6. And vex it. Let us make a breach therein for us. Set a king in the midst of it. And neither shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus. The head of Damascus is its king Rezin. Within 65 years shall Ephraim, the ally, be broken that it be not a people. it would be so broken and scattered that it would not be recognized as a people, and the head of Ephraim is Manasseh, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son, who was Pekah.